abandon free market principles to save the free market system.
In a world of conventional confusion,
There will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
Daddy, what do taxes pay for?
Oh, why everything. Policemen, trees, sunshine. And let's not forget the folks who just don't feel like working, God bless them.
Don't be afraid of your freedom.
Prepare to unshackle your mind.
An idea whose time has come cannot be stopped by any army or any government.
Your professor has arrived. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
Welcome, everybody. It is Wednesday, November 20th, 2013. And today, as promised, we're talking about the Old West. Man, have we heard all kinds of stories about this, right? Of course the Old West must have been a violent place. Of course it must have been a place where life and property were insecure. It must have been because there was little to no government there. We all know that the guarantor of civilized life is the government. And yet, according to our guest, the truth is exactly the opposite. That in fact there was far less violence in the Old West than we thought. And in fact, people figured out ways to establish property rights in land and other things and resolve disputes and, in other words, carry out so many of the functions that we associate with government. People thrown into this sort of situation where you have all kinds of people grasping at wealth and you would think there'd be no way they could cooperate, and yet they did. My guest today is P.J. Hill. Now, I could spend a few minutes of my opening banter talking about current events and things that are going on right now before getting to the guest. But I'm recording several programs in advance because I'm about to go on a little bit of a speaking tour. I've got four university appearances this week. So today's the day that I'm at St. Louis University at lunchtime. And then at 3 p.m. I'm at Lindenwood University in Missouri. So I've been recording the programs in advance so that I could travel. So if I try to talk about current events, I would look completely ridiculous because it would be 6 days later that you're actually hearing this and they wouldn't be so current anymore. And maybe by now they've found a solution to the problems with Obamacare, for all I know. I suppose I probably could have rolled the dice on that one, come to think of it. But anyway, we're going to go right to the guest then today. Our guest is P.J. Hill. Professor Hill is Professor Emeritus, George F. Bennett Professor Emeritus of Economics at Wheaton College. He is a senior fellow at the Property and Environment Research Center in Bozeman, Montana. And his books are many. He has the book we're talking about today, which he co-authored with Terry Anderson, called The Not-So-Wild Wild West. But he's also the author of The Birth of a Transfer Society, Growth and Welfare in the American Past, and Eco-Sanity, A Common Sense Guide to Environmentalism. He's also the editor of the following books: The Technology of Property Rights, The Privatization Process, A Worldwide Perspective, Wildlife in the Marketplace, The Political Economy of the American West, Environmental Federalism, and Who Owns the Environment? So P.J. Hill is uniquely positioned to talk to us today about the Old West, and it's my great pleasure to welcome P.J. Hill. Thanks so much for being here today.
I'm looking forward to it.
All right, so this book, which I just mentioned, The Not-So-Wild Wild West, published by Stanford, it really changes the way everybody thinks about the Old West. And yet, I would say the origins of this book almost surely are an article that you co-authored in the Journal of Libertarian Studies back in, I don't know, the late 70s?
Right. That took us a long time to write the book, after some 30 years after doing more work, but it does go back to that article. You might be interested to note that we wrote that article partially because of our interaction with David Friedman, whom you recently had on, and we called it at that point we called our work on the American West A Case for Anarcho-Capitalism. I'm not sure if we would still use quite that argument, but it's really for a lot of decentralized control.
Well, before we get into some of the details, it seems that there's also been a consensus among scholars of the Old West that our view of the amount of violence that existed at that time simply has to be scaled down. Is that your understanding of the literature?
Oh, certainly is. Because it's made good press, good pulp novels, good movies, we really see the West as just a case of unending violence. I'm interested to note that from 1850 through 1890 in all of the Western states, the best we can find was that there was less than a dozen bank robberies. Now, that's over 40 years in a whole bunch of states. Well, you know, you'd think there must be one every couple of days if you look at the movies or look at TV shows.
It's interesting. I mean, I understand how the dime novels get started. People want to sell books that are interesting and titillating for the public. But how did Hollywood, well, here I say this, I should be more cynical. How did Hollywood latch onto this? Of course, we expect Hollywood to be truthful and you know, right, stick to the script, right? But I mean, I wonder, how did that take off? Like, how did we get this so wrong for so long?
Well, I think part of it was that, you know, it's kind of the bad news sells sort of a thing. So violence oftentimes sells. The other thing is, I think people find it difficult to understand how, in the absence of formal government, people would organize themselves in a way that would be relatively orderly, relatively peaceful. So we say, look, we've got 30 or 40 or 50 years of life on the frontier. The federal government has almost no presence. The states are just being organized. And so what would you say? Well, surely this must be a case where violence prevails. And it turns out that wasn't the case.
And, of course, it seems that these particular circumstances were especially likely to foster violence because you have people who, many of whom, have no intention of laying down roots there. They're going to go and make their wealth and then leave, so you don't have the sort of community camaraderie. You have people of all different ethnic and national backgrounds, people coming from as far away as China to settle there. Mm-hmm. You would think this is just going to be an absolute nightmare. Like, there are a lot of people who would think without formal government, any situation would be a nightmare, but certainly this one. So how did you ever, I guess my primary question to get started is, how did you first begin to ask yourself if maybe there was more to this story than we had been led to believe? Like, why didn't you just go ahead and accept the standard view about the Old West?
Well, part of it is I grew up on the West, and my mother was one of the very first children born in eastern Montana, and her stories about, of course, that would have been just at the turn of the century, but her stories about life there was that it was a relatively peaceful, you could almost say, cultured, civilized way of living. And so that fascinated me, and then just started doing more reading of original resources. You read the stories about, you know, the diaries that cowboys kept as they trailed cattle north. You look at records on what happened on wagon trains. You look at what happening in mining camps. And you're right, in each one of these situations, there were valuable resources. People were armed. You would think that they would be competing for those resources by trying to shoot each other. Turned out most of the time that that's not what they did.
Now, you have a chapter here which is a little bit different from some of the themes we're going to talk about for the most part, but this chapter on property rights in Indian country, mm-hmm. I think just that title would be a bit shocking to some people because we've been sort of led to believe that the Indians, who are portrayed to us normally as one homogeneous blob, the right. Indians had no conception of property. And it's your view that to the contrary, not only did they have a conception of property, but they used that conception in ways that were conservationist and that were good for the environment in the long run.
Right. Basically, whenever resources were scarce and there was competition for them, they decided it probably made sense to form property rights. Now, among the nomadic tribes that were moving around a lot, they didn't necessarily have kind of well-defined property rights and land, and it's from looking at that the myth that the Indians had no property rights comes from, I think. But if you look at other sorts of situations, you look at Indians in the Pacific Northwest, they pretty clearly established property rights to the salmon spawning streams. Once the Indian got the horse, they clearly had property rights to their horses, and they even had a rental market in horses. A good buffalo hunting horse would be rented to a person who had the best abilities to ride through herds of buffalo and try to take one of them.
Now, suppose we're imagining people who are settling out in the Old West and maybe hoping to make their fortunes. There are certain sort of law and order type things that need to be done. You would need to establish some system for designating that this is my land and that's yours, or I mean, there are other issues we can get into later, like water rights and so on. How did they do that? How did they perform this basic function that we associate with government when, as you say, there was a very light to trivial federal presence? There was no organized state government at that point. Then how did this most fundamental function of government get carried out?
Basically, there was an agreement, and I don't know exactly how it, you know, first got started, but for instance, in a mining camp, they would decide what the size of a claim should be. And maybe it would be the first two or three or four people that would be there, the first dozen of people that would be there. So they would write out, and they oftentimes wrote them down so people could see them, about how big would a claim be. And it was oftentimes how much one person could work easily. And I think the basic reason was they discovered pretty quickly that arguing, fighting, particularly when some people are armed, is pretty expensive, and it's a lot better to try to get along. So I think fairly quickly they said, let's see if we can't decide, you own this chunk, I own that chunk, we'll establish some rules about how you define your property rights, you have to drive a stake in. Now, it wasn't the case that a person could just claim all up and down a stream and take anything they wanted to. The claims were limited, but maybe you would want to call that government. It's a very weak sort of a government, but at least there's an enforcement mechanism, and they did agree upon what a person could own.
Now, what do you mean? You have a chapter called Wagon Train Governments. Mm-hmm. What are these wagon train governments, and how would they compare to governments we're familiar with today, not in the Old West?
A lot of it, again, occurs because there's so much potential for violence. You've got this huge number of people between 1840 and 1860, about 300,000 people make their way across the Great Plains. They're trying to get to the California gold strikes after 1848, or they're trying to settle in Oregon. And so these people are coming together. Sometimes they know each other, sometimes they don't. Jumping off points were usually somewhere in Missouri, say St. Joseph, Missouri. So they'd form a wagon train of, say, 50 to 60 wagons. They'd find a wagon master. And again, it would appear that it would be pretty hard to get all of that organized. But they did form a government, and they actually, we call it a local government. They wrote wagon train constitutions almost, and so that was the agreement. I think the difference between that and what we think of as government today is it was very small, on a very small scale, and the cost of exit was pretty low. If you didn't like a wagon train, you could leave and go to another one. And just that cost of exit meant that government couldn't be as predatory as it oftentimes is when government gets big.
Now, how exactly is it, there's a discussion in here about the establishing the rights to livestock. Now, again, this is in a situation with very, very limited government presence. And mm-hmm. you have a discussion here about how rights to livestock were established and how roundup rules were established and how cooperation occurred in this way. So can you say a word about that?
Yes. Now, there was at least some formal registration of ownership, and one of the first things that a territory would do before it became a state would be to establish a brand ownership system, and there was a legal framework in which you could register your brand, and once cattle have a brand on them, then that belongs to that person, and there was at least a regional or sometimes a statewide registration system. For instance, I have a cattle brand, the PJ, and that was registered by my grandfather in 1894 in Montana, and any cow in the state of Montana that has a P on the left rib and a J on the left hip belongs to me unless a person that has that cow has a bill of sale. And so that was part of the way of establishing property rights, was just this ownership system in which people made marks that enabled those to be identified. But they were generally recognized, and it was pretty considered bad form. There were cattle thieves. They would alter brands or take cattle and try to drive them out of an area. But again, there was a general agreement that there would be some bad actors around, but that the community's general rules were that we ought to enforce property rights for each other. I think the overall idea would be, in the West, we saw lots of entrepreneurial activity, lots of productive activity, and not a lot of redistributive activity.
Well, how did people resolve the inevitable disputes that must have occurred? Were there formal institutions for dispute resolution?
In most cases, there were not formal courts. The things that David Friedman writes about in terms of people kind of coming together to form their own adjudicatory mechanisms we find exist. And so in a mining camp, it was pretty costly to have somebody be a sheriff in a mining camp. Everybody wanted to mine. So if there was a dispute, there would be a cry would go through the camp of claim jumper, and people would rush to some designated gathering spot. They would impanel a jury on the spot, and the person that was supposedly the claim jumper could make their case as to why they weren't, and the other people would make a case as to why that person was a claim jumper. If the person was found guilty, they were usually banished from the camp. It was pretty expensive to maintain a jail and to incarcerate them there. But again, spontaneous institutions do arise to solve these sorts of problems, and the same thing happened with wagon trains when there were questions of theft. Now, in some sense, you could say they had almost a memory of, say, the British common law or something like that, because there was the right to trial by jury and a jury of your peers. But those sorts of institutions came about fairly quickly whenever there were disputes that had to be resolved.
Now, how about dealing with water rights out in an arid environment? Mm-hmm. Again, it would seem like water rights might be tricky to designate. And yet, apparently, that was done too.
Yeah, that happened most. It started in mining camps in California, that it made sense to divert the water from the stream in order to engage in something we call sluicing, washing gravel to try to get the gold out. The water rights regime that the U.S. inherited from England didn't allow any property rights in diverted water. So a brand new doctrine developed in the West called the Doctrine of Prior Appropriation, and it allowed people to divert water for mining. Eventually that came about to also work for agriculture. And that has worked quite well. I would say part of the problem is that states eventually adopted the Prior Appropriation Doctrine, but in a sense, they froze in place the rules that were there once the states decided to take that doctrine up. And so we now still have a lot of water rights conflicts. Most of that is because we don't have regimes that allow water to be transferred from one place to another. And that's oftentimes because of state rules that prevent it.
Now, the overall thesis of this book is, as you doubtless realize, quite striking, especially to the lay reader. So I have to say, I'm very curious to know, especially since the book was published by Stanford. So, you know, it's not published by Joe's Publishing House, so that gives it a certain plausibility to the scholarly reader. How was it received?
Reasonably well. We've had some disagreement about some minor parts of it. People want to argue about, if you get involved with a historian, they'll argue about, did you get the treaty date right on some particular part of it. But I would say that whenever we've been able to present our evidence, generally people have said, yes, that seems to make sense. And generally also, if you talk with historians about any particular regime, like the mining camps or like wagon trains or like trailing cattle from, say, Texas to Montana, I would say there's a pretty good consensus that what we have in there is correct. What people haven't done is tried to draw that all together and say, what does this tell us about government overall? How do you get government that works well? And one of the ways you get it is by starting small and trying to keep it small. And I think that's where our lessons would be generally accepted by historians in most situations. But trying to pull all of that together into some sort of an understanding of institutions and how they develop is what I would say is probably the main point of the book.
Well, it's obviously not a coincidence that you have an interest in topics like this, and you also are a senior fellow at the Property and Environment Research Center there in Montana. So can you maybe take a few minutes to tell people about what PERC is and what kinds mm-hmm. of things it's doing?
PERC works largely on resource questions, environment and natural resource issues. We approach it from what I would call a free market perspective, which means we think property rights are important and getting the incentives right are important. So much of our environmental policy in the U.S. is what I would call top-down, command and control. We'll just tell people to not do bad things, and we'll tell them to do more of good things. We think it would be a lot better to start from the bottom up and try to think about most of the issues as property rights issues. They're usually property rights conflicts when we're talking about environmental issues. And so we think a lot about where are the incentives wrong in terms of environmental policy and how can we go about getting them right.
Now, I know we hadn't agreed to discuss this beforehand, but I'm very interested in the work that PERC does, and I'm very supportive of it. So I just can't help asking another question or two. Now, especially in Montana, I mean, in a lot of these states, there are a lot of landowners who have had bad experiences with federal environmental bureaucrats or the EPA. How does PERC help them out? Does PERC instead do policy studies saying that maybe the federal government ought to take a different approach? And what types of disputes do you see, especially in Montana, the federal government having with just your ordinary landowner?
A lot of the disputes have to do with things like EPA regulations on land, say water rights or water areas. We get involved a lot in terms of water rights disputes. We get involved with Indian policy. That's a big issue in Montana. We think that a lot of the power has been taken away from the Indians on their reservations. We just had a conference that finished just last week on that topic, trying to give them much more control of their own sorts of destinies. We look at timber policy. Federal government owns a lot of the land here and has basically not managed it particularly well. It's turned out that bureaucratic incentives oftentimes stand in the way of good environmental policy. So we talk about those sorts of issues. We look at mining issues. So it's all of those sorts of things that we deal with.
Can you tell everybody what the website for PERC is? I bet it's pretty, guess it.
Yeah, you know, very straightforward. Just PERC.org, PERC.org. And we list our publications, of which there's a lot. We have a whole series of conferences. We have programs for graduate students and undergraduates. We also publish a newsletter so people can get on the mailing list and find out more about us if they want to just go to PERC.org.
Well, I hope people will do that. I strongly recommend it. The book is The Not-So-Wild Wild West, Property Rights on the Frontier. This is it's a tremendous thing, I think, to be able to say that you were involved in a seriously revisionist work that will forever change the way we think about a chapter of our history. I mean, what a privilege to be involved in a project like that. And I hope people will rush out and get copies, and budding historians will see this is how it's done. So, PJ Hill, thanks so much for taking some time with us today.
Thank you.
All right, everybody, that was PJ Hill of the Property and Environment Research Center, PERC. PERC.org is the website. Check them out. Tomorrow, we're going to be joined by Carla Garrick of the Free State Project for an update on what's going on in New Hampshire. Friday, Danny Sanchez of the Mises Institute will talk about the method of Austrian economics. Are Austrians unscientific, as their critics say? We'll talk to him. And then at some point next week, I'm going to have my wife on as a guest. I want to have her on to, first of all, to talk about how to prepare a decent edible turkey for Thanksgiving. How to prepare a moist turkey. My wife makes the best turkey in the world, and she's going to share her secret with you guys. But then we want to know, what else should we talk about? Are there things that you'd like to ask her? Then, if so, like my page on Facebook, which you can do by just going to tomwoodsradio.com and clicking on the little like button on the Facebook widget, because you can't find me as Tom Woods on Facebook. I'm on there as Thomas E. Woods Jr., and that can't be helped, unfortunately. But what should I ask my wife? What can we talk about, and you guys listen in, that would be interesting, that would have something to do with, I don't know, libertarianism or our family or whatever. I don't know. Is there anything you want to know? Because we'll talk about that. But mainly, we're going to talk about how to have an edible turkey on Thanksgiving. You're going to impress everybody with your turkey. And you know what? We're not jealous people. You can take credit for the great turkey. You can say, well, you know, I was up all night and I researched this and I've read several books about it and I've consulted scientists and I came up with this ideal turkey. That's absolutely fine with us. As long as you guys are happy, that's what matters. So that's what's coming up later this week and into next week. And remember, you can help us keep the lights on here in our little Tom Woods Show office at no cost to yourself by, when you're about to make a purchase on Amazon, entering Amazon at tomwoodsradio.com. And you can help us pay our bills and keep our little quiet little office where I make these programs for you. All right, everybody, thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.
The Tom Woods Show.